Welcome to the Summer of Peace, a free global online event designed to help you find inner peace and to take inspired action. The Summer of Peace is a production of the Shift Network, and this Global Compassion Summit is co-produced with Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, as well as the Charter for Compassion. The Global Compassion Summit highlights the latest science and practices that help us embrace compassion and recognize compassionate action as an important path to peace. We're so grateful that you're here. Please share your questions or insights at www.facebook.com/shiftnetwork. And now, your host for this call, Emily Hein, the director of the Global Compassion Summit.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. My name is Emily Hein, and I'm grateful to be your host for the Global Compassion Summit. It is a true privilege for me to introduce our next guest for the summit, Dacher Keltner. Dacher Keltner received his BA from UC Santa Barbara and his PhD from Stanford University. He is a full professor at UC Berkeley, faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center, and director of the Berkeley Social Interaction Lab. Dacher's research focuses on the biological and evolutionary origins of compassion, awe, love, and beauty and power, social class and inequality. He's the co-author of two textbooks and the best-selling Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, and The Compassionate Instinct. Dacher has published over 190 scientific articles. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, the London Times, the Nutney Reader, and has received numerous national prizes and grants for his research. He's collaborated with directors at Pixar and a design team at Facebook and on projects at Google, and he's received the Outstanding Teacher and Research Mentor Awards from UC Berkeley. Wired Magazine recently rated Dacher's podcast from his course, Emotions, as one of the 5 best educational downloads, and the Utney Reader selected Dacher for one of its 50 2008 visionaries. He lives in Berkeley with his wife and their 2 daughters. We are incredibly honored to have you with us here today. Welcome, Dacher Keltner.
Thank you, Emily.
Well, let's get started. This is a meaty topic that we have today. The title of your session is Survival of the Kindest, and you kindly offered to walk us through the evolutionary origins of compassion. So given that evolutionary origins, where would you like to start?
Sure. So, I'd like to start with a historian's really interesting observation from the 20th century's battlefields. And this is from a book by Jonathan Glover titled Humanity. And Glover surveys firsthand accounts of battle from the 20th century's battles. And what he observes is something that's really striking, and it was hard for evolutionary theory and science to really account for, which is what he calls sympathy breakthroughs, or you might call them compassion breakthroughs. And what happens on the battlefield is that when soldiers encounter their enemies, and they really encounter the humanity of their enemies, and they see their eyes, and they hear their voice, and they see their skin, they can't shoot them, right? They can't harm them, even when their lives are on the line and superior officers are telling them to do so. They break down in sympathy. And what that tells us, Emily, is that even in the most extreme adversarial circumstances, compassion and sympathy break through. They are part of human nature. Now, the evolutionary story about why compassion actually is both old and very recent. When early in evolutionary scholarship, when the early theorists in evolutionary thinking were thinking about human nature, here I'm thinking about Thomas Huxley and Alfred Russel Wallace, the co-discoverer of evolution, they had what is a very common view of human nature, which was they're cynical, and they felt that there's no way that if evolution is about survival of the fittest, that you could actually have kind, compassionate, altruistic tendencies in the human design, because those would be costly and perilous to the self. And Alfred Russel Wallace felt that sympathy was created by God, Thomas Huxley, who was a very prominent intellectual at the time of Charles Darwin, said that compassion was a cultural construction. That is, we're, you know, our basic nature is violent and greedy, and we have to create society around norms and rules of compassion. It isn't in our evolved nature. Now, you know, one of the really striking things about doing Born to be Good is I read up on a lot of Charles Darwin just to get my evolutionary footwork founding right. And Darwin had a really different view, and a lot of historians believe that this view of compassion came out of his experiences both as a devoted dad of 10 kids and also the fact that he had to watch one of his beloved daughters, Annie, pass away from what historians think is tuberculosis. And he literally nursed her for a couple of years all the way to her death. And out of those experiences, Darwin had this really radical view, in particular when situated in Western thought, which is that, and I'm going to quote Darwin, he really advocated survival of the kindest, which is that sympathy, quote, will have increased through natural selection for those communities which included the greatest number of the most sympathetic members would flourish the best and rear the greatest number of offspring. And so what Darwin was saying very sensibly, you know, and I know people in movements surrounding compassion know this intuitively and see it with their eyes, which is that when compassion takes hold in a network or a community or a neighborhood, that community does better. And that, in effect, is what Darwin is arguing. Now, it turns out, if you fast forward in scholarship, there are very sound reasons why we've evolved compassion, and they have to do with how profoundly vulnerable our offspring are. As we started to walk upright, our pelvises narrowed. As we developed big brains, our heads expanded. And for those and other reasons, we women give birth to our children prematurely, and they are the most vulnerable mammal on the face of the earth, taking, you know, 7 to 45 years to reach the age of independence. I mean, they require continual care the first several years of life, and really care throughout the long childhood of humans. Now, what that meant, really straightforwardly, is take care or die, right? If we don't take care of our vulnerable offspring, our genes don't get to the next generation, and we don't live as a species. And that raw fact, that physical fact of childbirth and the nature of our vulnerability of our offspring, led to the evolution of compassion. So what my work has done scientifically, and I'll give you, you know, before we can start talking about the kind of the practical implications of this work and how do we cultivate compassion, what my work has done has, with different kinds of evidence that I'll tell you about, has really made the case that just like anger and fear, which people have no trouble thinking is a basic part of human nature, we have the same kind of evidence for compassion. It is built into our DNA. So a first thing that we've done, and this is continuing in the tradition of Charles Darwin, is people now know that a universal part of human nature is our capacity to express emotion in the face and voice, and other means. And so people in my lab, like Dan Cordero, have gone to remote parts of the world to look at whether humans who really have not encountered the West or live in radically different cultures, like Islamic cultures, nevertheless express emotions and, in this specific case, compassion in very similar ways. And what we found, and it's so fascinating, is that we convey compassion with what are called vocal bursts. They're very brief bursts of sound that have this rich communicative function. They probably predate language in the evolution of human communication. And we have a vocal burst that communicates compassion. It sounds like, and anyone, when I ask them to produce it, what does compassion sound like, would immediately produce something like, oh, right? It's this wonderfully evocative sound that conveys to other people, I feel compassion. Now, remarkably, primatologists have been studying what primates do out in the wild, And it's so striking, primates, when their offspring die, in particular the great apes, they'll often carry around their offspring for several days and hold the offspring and touch it and bring it to its face. And not only that, but much as in humans, primates will emit what are called coos, which are these compassion-sounding vocalizations when they see another primate holding their dead offspring. So we see the rudiments of compassion in other species. So our first piece of evidence is, incredibly, radically different cultures, in our primate relatives, we're showing similar patterns of expressive behavior coded in our DNA that are part of this compassion response. Next stop in this evolutionary argument for compassion is this really interesting argument that Darwin anticipated in his quote, which is that communities with the most sympathetic members will flourish the best. Communities with the most sympathetic members will flourish the best. And the idea is actually a very deep idea in evolutionary scholarship, which is that, simply put, when people in social networks have very cooperative, compassionate ties to one another, they'll do better. And one of the things that helps build up these sympathetic, cooperative ties to one another is compassion and kindness, more generally, are contagious. And here's the thinking, and this has been addressed by people who study game theory, which is this mathematical approach to cooperation, people like Robert Novak, is that if I'm compassionate to anybody, they exploit me or they take advantage of me, I lose, right? If I'm compassionate to somebody who's competitive or Machiavellian or really greedy, and they notice that I'm willing to sacrifice as a default, they can exploit me. And so they're, in those sort of circumstances, compassion doesn't do well in social networks. Where it really increases its chances of spreading and doing well is if compassion can spread to other people at an intuitive, unconscious level, that it's viral or that it's contagious. And in fact, guided by this notion, there are a lot of data showing that kindness and compassion spread through social networks. Studies find that neonates will cry when they hear another neonate cry. Studies find that if I see somebody do something altruistic, I feel inspired and elevated, and I behave more altruistically. Studies find that if I give a resource to a stranger, that stranger then goes on to give more resources to other strangers when I'm not there. And then those strangers go on to give more in their subsequent interactions, showing this sort of pay-it-forward, contagious compassion finding. You can study workplaces and find that where people give a lot to charity in sectors of organizations, everybody around them gives a lot to charity. It's good, kind behavior. It's very viral and very contagious. So my students and I, this in particular was Matt Hertenstein, who's turned into probably the world's touch expert, or the science of touch expert, what we decided to do is to look at the very direct ways in which we can spread compassion to others to test this thinking that compassion is contagious. So what we've done is created this paradigm where one person comes to the lab. There's this big barrier in the middle of the room. They sit on one side. They stick their arm through the barrier and a curtain in it. Another person then comes into the lab. They see this arm sitting on a table, and they're given a list of emotions. They have to reach out, touch that arm, and try to communicate different emotions like anger or fear or compassion or gratitude or love. Then the person who's been touched guesses what was just communicated, to try to see how rich a language we have with touch to communicate these emotions. And what we find in many different countries is just with a brief half-second touch, we can convey compassion really reliably with remarkable fidelity to a stranger. It has this very rich, unconscious language to it And then when you add all that we know about from the science of touch, that soothing, compassionate touch to a stranger makes the person studies show more physiologically calm. It activates oxytocin in the blood, which is a kind of a neuropeptide that helps people cooperate. It makes people more cooperative. It makes people sort of feel more committed to doing well. So we have this incredibly rich language of touch that promotes compassion, kindness, and altruism in social networks. So finally, one of the strongest kinds of evidence for the claim that something has evolved, that it's in evolutionary terms an adaptation, is physiological evidence, right? That you can take a characteristic that is hypothesized to be a trait evolved that has been produced by human evolution. And if you can find physiological systems that are part of that trait or genes that help build up those systems that are part of the trait, you feel fairly convinced that the thing you're talking about has been evolved. And so in my lab, we have been using different methods to really capture the compassionate nervous system. And what we do is we bring people to the lab and we show them very profound images of serious suffering. So they will see babies in a famine who are dying, or they will see children who have lost their hair going through chemotherapy when they have cancer. Very powerful images. And the intention is to really trigger as strong an experience of compassion as you could in the lab. And what's really remarkable is, from our standpoint and from the argument that compassion has been crafted by evolution so much so that it's built into our nervous systems, is there are branches of our nervous system that serve compassion, that enable compassion. So when you see images of harm, it activates a part of your brain near your brain stem called the periaqueductal gray. And the periaqueductal gray is a very old part of the mammalian nervous system. And when you stimulate it in other mammals, those mammals will take care of anything around them. So what we're seeing is compassion actually activates a very old region of the mammalian nervous system. It has evolved through mammalian evolution. The periaqueductal gray, down there in the brainstem, below the midbrain, it's a very old part of your nervous system, communicates with oxytocin networks, and the oxytocin story is remarkable and relevant to compassion. Oxytocin, it's a sequence of 9 amino acids, it's produced in your hypothalamus, it goes up into your brain, it's distributed through your blood, helps with all of the stuff of childbirth and child rearing, milk, you know, uterine contractions, milk let down, connections to the baby when it's born, breastfeeding. And a lot of studies are showing that it's associated with kindness and sharing, reading in people's emotions well, stuff that relates to compassion. And what we've found is people who have a particular gene that's associated with high levels of oxytocin actually tend to be more compassionate. So there's a compassion gene. And then finally, back to that, those images of suffering. When you see an image of suffering, starving babies, and when one, an older sibling is feeding a starving younger sibling, it activates the vagus nerve, which is the largest bundle of nerves in your body that goes from your brainstem down into your nervous system, and it slows your heart rate, it activates muscles in your throat to help you look at people. It regulates digestion and immune response. There was a hypothesis by Steve Porges that it helps people connect and take care of others. And we now have demonstrated in 8-9 studies that when we feel compassion and not other positive states like pride or amusement or I'm inspired, when we feel compassion, it activates the vagus nerve response. So putting that all together, that really starts to speak to this part of our nervous system, encoded in particular genes that built up in evolution to help us feel compassion. So these data tell us the evolutionary story, just to sum up, is our offspring, the carriers of our genes, are very vulnerable. We have to have evolved emotions and systems to take care of those offspring. We can communicate them with universal signals in the voice and the face. It's a highly contagious emotion, so we can spread compassion, kindness, and social networks. And it has physiological structures or systems that are activated when we feel compassion and make us do this good work.
Wow. That was incredibly informative and very helpful, especially, I mean, really, truly, for people who are both studying compassion and those who are just wanting to be more compassionate and perhaps inspire others to be compassionate.
Yeah.
So we know there's this compassion gene. We know that it activates the vagus nerve, and we know that there are all these benefits, including the release of oxytocin, which is just all over goodness. So how, you know, since we know it's good for us and it's evolved and it's hung in there through evolution, how do we then cultivate it in our brains, in our physiology, and in our actions?
Well, I mean, I think that you know, and I love your summary, Emily, and I think that the cultivation question is something that you know, our culture is enjoying a serious renaissance about this, you know, and when I started this science 10, 15 years ago, you know, I would often think, well, God, how do we spread this? And now there are a lot of people actively working on it. So, for example, you know, there are mindfulness exercises that really begin, and they're so interesting to analyze anatomically and biologically. So, you know, mind, like you take a loving kindness exercise of breathing deeply, you know, following your breath, getting into a still place, and then, you know, and I'm thinking of Jon Kabat-Zinn or Alan Wallace or other programs, and then gradually thinking kind thoughts to people who are close to you or to relatives, friends, loved ones, strangers, and if you're really good at it, to adversaries. And, you know, what we know scientifically is those techniques, slow your breathing down, which activates the vagus nerve, especially patterns of deep exhalation. They lead to oxytocin release. They lead to rising vagus nerve response. This is a paper by Barbara Fredrickson. They lead to reductions in the inflammation response, which is really good news for your physical health. They lead to these kindness techniques, lead to stronger relationships with people around you. So, you know, the first thing that I teach everybody, literally, you know, from students in my Berkeley classes to, you know, people in San Quentin Prison that I've been lucky enough to teach to, you know, scientists at biotech firms, is like, all right, here's what you do. You know, make sure you're breathing, make sure you're mindful of that every now and then. Build in a little bit of kindness to your thinking. So that's one approach. You know, a second thing that I think is really important is really to translate it to action, you know, and I think that we need to, as Phil Zimbardo has with his Hero Project, is like really sort of bring into our awareness all the acts that are courageous and heroic in our daily lives. And not only the obvious ones of volunteering and giving to charity and sharing resources, which we know boost people's health and happiness, but I, you know, in particular coming out of the tradition that I've worked in, just cultivate the everyday practice of compassion, you know, pat a student on the back. Use a softer tone of voice. Ask a great question of somebody you're leading. You know, be calm and open when your teenager is really emotionally volatile and always move toward tenderness or kindness. You know, it's hard in our busy lives and also it's hard in our more Western mindset. But the data are in that those very simple everyday practices really benefit compassion as well.
I appreciate the response and kind of the nodding back to mindfulness as a core component. It seems to be a theme with many of the talks that we've heard during this Global Compassion Summit, the importance of mindfulness. And some people have chosen to take a kind of perhaps more spiritual approach to mindfulness. When you have been teaching your students, and assuming that there are some people on this summit who might just want to get started with mindfulness, you know, what are your kind of ABCs of getting started? And you don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but I think people would value your response.
Yeah, thank you. You know, we have good material on our Science of Happiness edX class at the Greater Good Science Center, which is free. UCLA has some nice audio, little 3-minute audio units on mindfulness. You know, what I teach people, and it's so interesting, you know, I'm not a serious practitioner, probably get in a few minutes a day. You know, and I've just thought, you know, this stuff's so useful for me that I want to, whatever audience I'm with, and, you know, I've taught 400 Berkeley undergrads in a classroom. I've taught school kids. I've taught prisoners at San Quentin. Is, you know, start with your breathing, get into a deep pattern of expanding your chest to inhale, pressing in your abdomen to exhale. Build in a counting to it, if you like. Breathe in, count to six. Breathe out, count to six. And just, you know, get comfortable and feel that. And like with kids, I love doing this when they're standing up because they love to be physical. Boys especially, it's a little hard to sit down. So if you get them to stand up and you let them feel their bodies swaying, that becomes a form of physical mindfulness. And then you can direct them to sensations, like try to listen to things for 6 deep breaths. Try to feel the sun on your skin for 6 deep breaths. Feel the touch of a friend. And then you can get to, you know, it's worth trying loving, I think, kindness exercises. Just, again, you know, rooted in science, which is what is the warm feeling of your chest like when you feel really touched by somebody or you feel really close. So I like the breath. I like to make it physical, where you get people to think about sensations, and I like to make it then build in kindness. You know, and we have had experiences with our Science of Happiness online class that people really, even just a minute or two a day, really changes how they're doing in life. So I think it should be encouraged to as many as possible.
Thank you for that response. I want to ask another question, and this is going to reveal to you that I'm not a scientist, but I aspire. You've mentioned the vagus nerve a couple of different times, and I know that it's, you know, one of our longest nerves, I think, if I remember right, from my compassion training, and that it's part of the nervous system. Can you just educate us a little bit further about the role of the vagus nerve, you know, without going too scientific on us, but also, is there a way to exercise the vagus nerve?
Yeah, and again, you know, I mean, the vagus nerve,
forgive me for my...
You know, we're just learning about the anatomy of it, and that usually requires, obviously, that we study other mammals. But across mammals, but not in reptiles, as far as we know, is this massively long bundle of nerves that originates in your spinal cord, and then it wanders through your body, and, you know, these patterns of cells are connecting up to your heart and your lungs, and they regulate your heart, your patterns of inhalation and exhalation to slow your heart rate down. Then it, the vagus nerve moves to your stomach and is very involved in digestion and those sorts of processes. It reaches out to your immune system and regulates the immune system response. So it is this, it's really quite striking. I remember a colleague, a neurologist, doing a classroom demonstration. He brought in a model of the primate's nervous system. And there's the brain, which everybody thinks about. Then coming out of the bottom of the brainstem is this long bundle of nerves. I was like, what is that? He said, that's the vagus nerve. So if this really, it is the anatomical mind-body connection. And in terms of exercising it, you know, it's so fascinating. So one of the primary functions of the vagus nerve is to slow your heart rate down and to slow the stress response down. So it's part of the parasympathetic autonomic nervous system. And there are, you know, one of the ways we can look at vagus nerve function is in terms of your heart rate or your heart rate variability, how much it sort of fluctuates over time, and then some other indicators as well. And you can exercise it. So deep breathing on a regular basis through yoga or meditation helps strengthen your vagus nerve. You can, I think, exercise. Very often you find athletes or people who exercise a lot have lower resting heart rate, which is indicative of high vagus nerve activation. You know, Barb Fredrickson's very important study showed over 8 weeks as the person engages in kindness meditations, a few minutes a day, they show elevated or increases in vagus nerve activation. We know when you give to people, you have elevated vagus nerve. So it tells us that a lot of these things, like breathing and kindness meditations and giving, compassion, even just exposing yourself to suffering, increases your vagus nerve. So a lot of the tried and true techniques people have been interested in terms of happiness, also increase vagus nerve function.
Fascinating. Well, you know what I also think of is, because it originates in the nerves, but it's impacted the heart and the lungs and the stomach. What about singing?
I bet I would you know, no one studied that to my knowledge, and I bet you singing and chanting have massive effects on vagus nerve function. It's a great idea.
Maybe that will be my first scientific exploration.
Go for it.
All right.
Hold on.
Okay. I think I have a little more education to get about this, but regardless, let's take it from the individual level to the social level. So given what you know in the kind of evolutionary aspects of kindness and compassion, how do we cultivate compassion at the social level?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that there's so many different ways, right? So I think that they're very intuitive ways, like making sure, you know, like the United States, a lot of people volunteer. And people will, when they find the right form of volunteering, or they will feel like it's the most meaningful work in their lives, right? And that, I guarantee, in those peak experiences of that, is activating the vagus nerve. So to the extent that we can build in more systemic volunteering. I think your question or your observation, Emily, is actually really one of these deep indicators, which is, you know, kids, you know, anybody who's raised kids in today's hyper-competitive environment, like I saw the pressure of seventh grade just knock out the vagus nerve in my daughter. You know, I'm speaking loosely here, but, you know, we need to use these kinds of data to first pause, like, well, why are kids more stressed out today than they were 30 years ago? What's missing? And what's missing are systemic, societal level things that, like unstructured play, touch, like rough and tumble play and touching activates the vagus nerve, like singing and art classes. Like drama, where, you know, you do this performative exercise. So I think we really have to take a step back. You know, we've always undervalued compassion in our society. So think about the very deep, ancient, tried and true practices that will activate compassion in the vagus nerve. And then I think, you know, it's, and people are doing this, like the C-Care programs of just taking what we know about compassion and then looking at societal institutions like the medical healthcare institution. And I think we'll make progress by building in the tools of compassion into those institutions.
Well, speaking of institutions, you mentioned San Quentin earlier, and I know this is an important topic for you personally. How do you think we make an institution kind of like our criminal justice system more compassionate?
Wow. One of the things, it's been really interesting, you know, to teach compassion for 10 years, 15 years, and I really, you know, you see movements like your movements and CTER and people thinking about it in the healthcare setting. And then all of a sudden, you know, as an American citizen, you see the footage of Freddie Gray and Eric Garner and Mike Brown and the thing that just happened in Texas, you know, cop throwing young kid to the ground. You look at systems, and I think we need to look at systems in terms of the degree of compassion. And clearly, all the data are in about our criminal justice system. And I was very moved early in this by an essay by Atul Gawande, a great writer and a medical doctor, who said solitary confinement is a form of torture. It's worse than anything a human being can endure, except perhaps if they have to inflict solitary confinement or torture on somebody else. And so, you know, I've been very interested in working on, you know, how do we soften what is the most coercive, harsh criminal justice system in the industrialized world in terms of prison sentence length, solitary confinement, racial bias. So, you know, you can get engaged with teens, you know, at places where they're trying to teach teens who don't get the easy opportunity to learn this stuff about how do you breathe, how do you handle stress. I participate in a restorative justice program in San Quentin where the restorative justice movement is based in compassion. It's the idea that, you know, people who perpetrated harm ultimately regret it. They feel horrible and ashamed about it and feel compassion for their victims. And then society, through the expression of that compassion, will feel compassion towards perpetrators. And I can tell you, you know, having been with the Men in Blue for, you know, dozens of hours, that those programs are a very compelling alternative to retributive justice. And what you see, you know, like I saw in my second visit, is a guy who used to be a skinhead apologizing to a lot of African Americans about his crimes and them embracing it, right? And that being the kind of social change that our system needs. So I think there are a lot of compassion. You know, Karen Armstrong, the great historian, said compassion is, and Martha Nussbaum has said this as well, a great philosopher, compassion is this cardinal virtue. If you can find it, it tends to point you to effective action in almost every context. And I think the same is true with criminal justice, that there are a lot of good things to do.
I appreciate that you brought up restorative justice and how complex this topic is. I think one of the elements of restorative justice that is just so beautifully human is recognizing, you know, two things. One, the common humanity that we have with one another. That, you know, if I'm looking at, as you say, you know, the Men in Blue or an individual prisoner, and I might not think I have anything in common with that person, but I can recognize that just like me, this is somebody's son or daughter. You know, just like me, this person has a family. Just like me, this person has friends. And just like me, this person suffers. And they suffered so much that it caused them to take action that was contrary to their values as a human being. And that action harmed somebody. But just to recognize that this person was also suffering and in pain, and that's why they took this kind of, you know, counterintuitive action that caused harm. I'm really appreciating the restorative justice, and I'm hopeful that we continue to expand that in our prison system.
Well summarized.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, in the last few minutes that we have, a little bit about some of the tools that people can access. You're the faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center, and this is, you know, just such an extraordinary organization, and also, as you know, and thank you so much, a co-sponsor of this Global Compassion Summit, which means that Greater Good Science Center embraced the concept of what we were doing and agreed to promote it for us. Could you give some of our listeners a high-level overview of the Greater Good Science Center? And I know you've already mentioned some of the tools and resources, but if you could expand a little bit more, I think people would really benefit from knowing more about the wonderful work there.
So, you know, thanks for bringing that up. You know, 12 years ago, a couple of alumni from Cal, Berkeley, Tom and Ruth Ann Hornaday, wanted to build something, and coming out of a very really the worst kind of personal trauma, losing a child, that would create more peace for human beings. And with their support, 12 years ago, we started the Greater Good Science Center. You know, at the time, the science of compassion and cooperation, gratitude, touch, all of these things was in its kind of infancy, and it was getting off the ground. And what we wanted to do, you know, not only is to fund fellows and scientists, but just as importantly, to get those findings outside of the walls of the ivory tower, if you will, because they have enormous, like, you know, as we've been talking today, they have so much utility to everybody. So we started a magazine called Greater Good. Greater Good is this idea that came out of utilitarian philosophical thinking in the 18th and 19th centuries, that the key is to lift up as many people's welfare as possible, which I think is a pretty good idea. And after the magazine, we then built out this website with workshops for healthcare providers, and the website just exploded way beyond our wildest dreams. And now, you know, we have a website translating the science in very compelling prose, because academics don't usually write very compelling prose, to 500,000 people, I think, a month. We have an institute for teachers, because our next interest was to get this science into the hands of people who are changing a lot of lives at critical times, teachers. So we've got 150 teachers coming into Berkeley to learn this stuff. We host a lot of workshops, and then starting to think about healthcare and how to, alongside C-Care and others, to get this to healthcare. And then the critical thing, there are a couple of things that are really relevant to the compassion movement. One is Emiliana Simon-Thomas and I, with Jason Marsh, did a edX MOOC. So edX is the host. A MOOC is a massive open online course. We titled it The Science of Happiness. A lot of it's about compassion. And we had over 200,000 people enroll, and it's free, and it's at edX. And then the other thing that we've just launched is called The Greater Good in Action. And what it is a sort of a menu of all the practical things with guidelines and tips about what you can do to cultivate compassion or gratitude or awe or mindfulness. And Jason Marsh really oversaw that and took, like, the best science-based practices, and I've kind of talked about a few today, that you can really, you know, in a few minutes, I mean, it's unbelievable. Like, when I taught Science of Happiness this past semester, I was like, God, how do I teach somebody this kind of loving kindness exercise? So I go to the Greater Good Action, find something, and I could use it, right? So very usable, fun things that people can go to right now, the Greater Good in Action.
Wow. You also mentioned, I think, the Science of Happiness course, and that has been, as you said, over 200,000 people signed up when you first launched it.
And, you know, 200,000 people at edX. Great reviews, high stay with it rates, and also, you know, all over the world. you know, I'm getting emails from people in Indonesia and Pakistan and England and Brazil, just talking about how they're using the class.
Okay. And so people can just go to Greater Good and find the course there?
Yeah, or they can go to edX, E-D-X, and Google Science of Happiness, and they'll get there.
Okay. Okay, fantastic. Perfect. And it's free. We love that. Thank you so much. Well, we're about to that point. Speaking of free, you've given your time for free today, so I really want to honor that. Considering, you know, what we've talked about, what you've presented, do you have any final suggestions for our listeners who will be coming from all over the world as well, besides checking out Greater Good Science Center and the wonderful resources there? Anything else, maybe on a more personal level, that they could do to cultivate more compassion in their own lives or their communities?
Well, you know, I mean, I just think that breathe more, touch more, look into people's eyes more. These are really old systems that help us feel compassion. And then I think that, you know, here in the United States, we have an ambivalent attitude towards suffering, and we kind of want to move away from it and get away from it and not think about it. But I think you really have to embrace it and to dive in and make things better. So I think those are some paths and final words.
Thank you. I think that last statement is really profound, and the irony is that doing compassion training can actually help one be with suffering in such a way that you actually liberate yourself. You're no longer afraid to suffer because you've got the tools to deal with it. At least that's been my experience. So, well, wow, Decker, it's so clear. You've made such a significant contribution, you know, not only to the field of compassion, but to the larger and expansive field of being human. So thank you so much for using your heart, your intellect, your precious time, and your energy for these noble efforts that truly benefit our collective human experience and our human evolution. We are very, very grateful you could be with us today. Thank you.
Well, thanks for including me, Emily.
Absolutely. Once again, if you'd like to learn more about Decker's work or take the Science of Happiness course, please visit greatergood.berkeley.edu, and or you could pick up one of Decker's books from your local bookstore. Thank you, everybody, for joining us for this comprehensive conversation with Decker Keltner. We are so grateful for your participation and your dedication to joining us for the Global Compassion Summit. Please join us for the next session. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for the Summer of Peace, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community dedicated to helping people awaken to their divine humanity and take inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the Summer of Peace and the World Peace Library, visit summerofpeace.net. Thank you for sharing this summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.